My name is Dario Hasenstab. I have 2 degrees in international affairs, and I'm here with Balder Hagritz, a former university professor of mine, as well as an IR consultant. And together, we're bursting the Western bubble. Today, we will analyze the role of the military in the West through the lens of the Western bubble, because while Western societies have many strengths and significant weaknesses, in order to analyze these, we use the concept of the Western bubble. If you would like to know more about this concept, how this podcast started, or who we are, make sure to listen to our introduction episode. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we speaking about the military?
Hi, Dario. Well, ask your average person in Western Europe whether their country is peaceful or not. The answer will be yes. My country represents peace. However, the Western bubble, as we've discussed it, represents also the largest military the world has ever known, and a military that is being used very actively as part of its foreign policy without many clear positive outcomes from that. And yet, unfortunately, now in 2024, you see a clear increase in military expenditure, in the use of the military, and it's worth analyzing that. Where does that comfort with the military come from, given that it hasn't actually provided much value for Western foreign policy?
And what are the facts?
Total global military expenditure increased by 3.7% in real terms in 2022 to reach a new high of $2,240 billion. The three largest spenders in 2022, the United States, China, and Russia, accounted for 56% of the world total. The United States led the ranking of countries with highest military spending with $877 billion dedicated to its military. That constituted nearly 40% of the total military spending worldwide in that year. This amounted to 3.5% of the US's GDP, placing the US lower in the ranking of military expenditure as percentage of GDP than Saudi Arabia, Israel, Qatar, Algeria, and Russia. China was the second largest military spender with an estimated $292 million. Military expenditure in Europe saw also its steepest year-on-year increase in at least 30 years following the war in Ukraine.
What is the bubble?
So we just heard a lot of numbers, very many of them. And I think it might be a bit misleading when we're talking about the three largest military spenders in 2022 amounted to 56%. And then we need to look at the number that, the United States basically is 40% of the global budget. That's a lot, right? That means the other 16% is for China and Russia, who are 2 and 3 in that list.
Yes, and then really you should add to the United States NATO as a whole, and then you get into a incredibly large percentage of global expenditure. And that has been consistent since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. The United States has always, over the past 70 years, been the largest military spender because of its huge economy. Since the 1990s, there hasn't been any serious rival to that military expenditure. But what is really interesting here is that the West feels the need to actually increase that, right? The United States has always had this kind of steady increase because its specific relationship with its military. But now you see other NATO countries also very, very aggressively increasing their military budgets. And you have to ask yourself, why, given that you are already by far the most dominant military force on the planet?
I mean, because there's some other countries on, right, particularly when we're talking about the military budget as part of GDP, there's some countries which are higher there, which we maybe wouldn't expect. I think Russia is one that we would expect. Ukraine is on there as well. But those numbers are a bit skewed lately for Ukraine. But then we also see Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Algeria. And I mean, that to a certain extent makes sense because I'm pretty sure there's a feeling of needing to catch up. Right. I mean, because let's be honest, Europe and the United States, they have been building up their military for hundreds of years now. And in these other countries, you have a very recent influx of money with oil and gas, and therefore kind of needing to build up your military, particularly because you were living in a very militarized world.
Yes, and in some ways, this is also related to a lack of trust in the geopolitics of the West, right? So if you're Saudi Arabia, you don't know if in the next 50 years you can still rely on the United States or European allies to protect your interests, and therefore you're going to up the ante. But it's also a situation where if one country starts militarizing their foreign policy, then others follow, and it becomes this vicious circle where everyone falls into this military trap. And if you don't think about it, if so you just intuitively say, okay, it makes sense, Saudi Arabia needs to defend itself, needs to defend its interests, it should spend more on the military. And you could say the same about virtually every country in the world. But once you start actually asking yourself, what is that military supposed to do? What is the military actually achieving for you? Then the answer becomes much less obvious, especially if you're part of NATO and not Saudi Arabia or India or China.
Right, because, I mean, so foreign policy, right, the extension of domestic foreign policy, of domestic policy on an international level, what is that, right? What are your interests? And we see that within different countries, there's different approaches to this. And I would say that in the West, people largely believe their foreign policy to be a peaceful one, first of all, because domestically we're very peaceful, right? And now we're just extending this internationally. And so as you mentioned in the introduction of this episode, I'm pretty sure if you ask most Westerners on the street, is your country a force for good in the world, right? We've talked about this in previous episodes. They will 100% say yes. And then, oh, is your country very active with its military? They will most likely say no, and if so, only for good reasons, like bringing peace to Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very clear. For example, my own country, which I've ranted about quite a lot already, but the average person in the Netherlands believes their country to be a peaceful country. That is just, they understand that there is military action undertaken in different places around the world, but that's from their perspective as part of an international coalition to do good. Whereas if in reality, if you look at it, the Netherlands is very aggressive in its use of its military for such a small country that has very few geopolitical interests and usually doesn't work within UN frameworks, but works within NATO or even just US frameworks, which is a very different kind of way of using your military, right? For very specific interests, whether it's related to the war on terror, whether it's related to bombing the Houthis, whether it's related to Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya. And this is not compatible with that self-image of your average Dutch person saying we are a country that is peaceful. Then the word peaceful has no actual practical meaning. You are bombing places, you are killing people, you're killing civilians, you're destroying buildings. You are using your military might without UN or global legitimacy. In that moment, you're no longer a peaceful country.
Mm. And yet we believe, and when I say we, I of course I'm talking about the Western bubble and the West, that it's other countries that are usually the aggressors. I mean, let's put aside Russia, Ukraine, because I think that's a very obvious case right now where there's actual military aggression going on. But we particularly, for example, see this with regards to China, right? That we perceive China to be very aggressive militarily because, yes, they are expanding in the South China Sea and there's military drills in and around, more around Taiwan. But China, in its use of the military, is nowhere near what the West has been doing.
It's not even close. It's nowhere near the levels of Western militarization of their foreign policy. So again, your average Dutch person or Spanish person or German person might feel intuitively that China is a threat to world peace. But what they really feel is that China is a threat to the Western model, because China is not threatening world peace. China has not used its military for aggressive purposes. Western countries have consistently been aggressive on that world stage, and the world stage hasn't been aggressive against those Western countries, at least not in any Westphalian term. You can talk about terrorism. Terrorism has not been anywhere near as problematic as sometimes people believe it to have been. But at the very minimum, terrorists are not going to be dealt with by usual traditional military means. You can't, as we have seen over and over again. And yet the West is consistently using its power, its unrivaled military power, to try to achieve foreign policy aims. And that is incredibly destructive if you compare that then to China, which uses its economy, which uses its diplomacy to get its foreign policy goals achieved. No alien coming from outer space looking at this planet will say, oh, China are somehow the threat to peaceful interaction between nations. China haven't invaded another country for the past 40 years. The West have.
I very much like that alien perspective, right? Sometimes you do need to take a bigger step back and think about, okay, would an alien think that China is the major threat in the world right now? And I do think that that alien will most likely think no.
It's very obvious. It's not some kind of obscure, weird, deep analysis where I get lost in my thoughts. Any person who's just looking at the facts of the world today can see which countries have actually invaded other countries, which countries have bombed other countries, which countries have tried to impose their will through military means. And those countries do not include China. They do not include India. They include Western nations and, to a certain extent, Russia, of course.
And yet we still, right? I mean, partly with regards to China, a lot of it probably due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we still believe that we need to strengthen the military, right? I mean, the West already has the, I mean, NATO, when I'm talking about the West in this episode, it's very much NATO, has the biggest and strongest military in the world, spends by far the most, and yet still there is this belief that we need to strengthen this because otherwise, or else, right?
Yeah, there was, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of talk in the 1990s about a peace dividend, right? Hey, we don't need to spend on our military anymore. Why not? Because the existential threat of a world war breaking out between the two superpowers is gone. There is no chance of Soviet tanks reaching Berlin or reaching Madrid anymore. It's just not going to happen. Now we can cut back on our military. We can reduce our focus on violence and armed pressure. What we can do now is start creating a world where we work together in peaceful means, or through peaceful means, through diplomacy, through trade, etc., etc. That was very much the 1990s idea. And you see budgets being cut in the 1990s. Now, in 2024, this seems to have been completely forgotten, this idea that there's no longer an existential military threat, because there isn't. The West is not facing a military threat. Anyone who believes that Russia is gonna invade Poland after Ukraine doesn't know what they're talking about. And so there is now this complete ignorance about the peace dividend of the 1990s. We've forgotten the lessons of the past. And for some reason, we've convinced ourselves that the military is important again. And really, what I would guess is happening here is that people in the West feel simply insecure about the Western position in the world. The West is on the decline. We are becoming less influential. We're becoming less powerful. And then we have sort of a Pavlovian reaction of, oh, the world is becoming a scary place because we can't control it anymore. Let's build up our military again without any rational analysis to back that up.
But doesn't this fall under the prevention paradox, right? So I think most of us learned about the prevention paradox during COVID, right? So there were a lot of measures in the beginning, which led to no infections at an early stage. So people thought, oh, we don't need these measures maybe. The very same could be applied here is, I mean, because you just said that Russia is never going to invade Poland after Ukraine, right? So why is that the case? It's because NATO has the strongest military in the world. Then isn't that a prevention paradox to think, well, because we're so safe, we shouldn't invest more into the military, because, I mean, ultimately, we are safe, right? Kind of forgetting that spending a lot on the military in the first place is what makes us so safe now.
Right. Well, so that's a very long conversation that we can have about the role of the military in general. So let me first answer it by looking at the reality in 2024. And then we can talk about the paradox behind it a little bit more in depth. But right now in 2024, the Russian budget on the Russian expenditure on the military is roughly the same, more or less, as that of France, as that of Germany, as that of the UK, let alone the United States and all the other NATO allies together, right? So the idea that Russia is anywhere near, anywhere close in the next 10, 20, 30 years to achieving any kind of even parity with the West is simply false. Russia is so far away from their capabilities of actually threatening the West that right now, no prevention in that sense would even work, right? Even if you were to go down that argument, like whether the West outspends Russia by 7-1, which is what it does now, Europe outspends Russia by 7-1. NATO outspends Russia by, I don't know, maths, 30-1 or something like that. Even if Europe decreases its budget by 50%, they would still be way stronger militarily than Russia. So there's no prevention issue there. But then you get into the more complicated conversation, the more complex conversation of actually what makes you safe and what doesn't. NATO increasing its budget, what is more likely to happen? That Russia says, oh, we will just give up. Okay, we won't spend more. Or will they actually try to find ways to counter that? Either through increasing their own military expenditure, creating a vicious circle, or through ways to threaten NATO in non-conventional warfare, through nuclear weapons, through terrorism, through ways that they can circumvent their clear disadvantage in terms of military power, traditional military power. So the problem in this parallel is that at least with COVID, you can make the case, okay, if we have evidence that face masks work, then if everyone puts on face masks, now we can reduce the chances of COVID spreading. And the same with, of course, vaccinations. We know they work. So let's all have vaccines, and then they reduce the chances of the virus going from one person to another person. But in terms of military expenditure, the likelihood of your increase in military expenditure making you safer is actually not high at all. In fact, there's a very strong case that you spending more on your military leads to greater insecurity because your rivals will try to react to that. They will undermine it. It's not that they will go home and just forget about it all.
I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, what does a big and strong military, what does it allow you to do? It allows you to act. It allows you to bully the rest of the world, and it allows you to make mistakes that we will obviously get to in a few minutes when we're talking about, okay, what are maybe some of the negative consequences of the West's super strong military. On another note, I think I hope there's some smart people out there who can tell us what the prevention paradox versus vicious cycle dilemma could be called, because I think that gives us material for at least a few more hours of this podcast. I want to bring this part, right, or this what's the bubble conversation to an end, because we kind of need to talk about, okay, what does a strong military allow the West to do with regards to its foreign policy? Does it actually support the West's foreign policy aims, or does it undermine them?
Yeah, so this is the thing, right? At a very basic level, you can make the case, and there is a strong case to be made. Unless you are a diehard pacifist, it's hard, I think, to deny that you having at least a reasonable military ensures that there are no neighbors that are going to invade you. That's the basic, that's just a major foreign policy goal. Let's not be invaded by outsiders, right? Let's not get attacked by outsiders. Now, as we've just established, that is covered. We've got it covered. No one is going to invade the West. It's not going to happen now. It's not going to happen in 10 years' time. And if they do, that would be a huge blunder on their part.
then we have different problems to worry about.
Well, then, and then, yeah, exactly. Then we've got a whole different conversation on our hands. But the deterrence aspect is there. If anyone believes that somehow Russia isn't deterred by NATO expenditure, then they've been living under a rock. Obviously, it's there. Now, then the question is, beyond that deterrence, can your military actually be useful for other foreign policy goals? You have paraphrased Clausewitz there before at the beginning of the episode, continuation of politics by other means. So what do you actually achieve through military operations or military threats? And there the story becomes much less obvious. If you look at how the military has been used by the West, aggressively so, it actually hasn't led to the outcomes that you would desire as a Spanish or Dutch or German or American taxpayer. All the those billions and billions and billions spent on your military haven't actually led to an improvement in your foreign policy standing, in your geopolitical situation. It hasn't actually helped you deal with problems outside of your own nation. Why? Because the military is a very blunt object, blunt tool. It typically destroys. It's made to destroy. It's not made to create. It's not made to construct. It is there to kill. It is there to threaten. And that typically leads to counter-reactions, to anti-reactions. That leads to people being very upset with you, people starting to hate you, etc., etc.
What's the international relations context?
Well, let's actually look at what you just said in a case study, and this is what we like to do in this category when we look a bit at the real world, right, at the international relations world. And the easiest and most obvious case study here is obviously the United States, right? The United States has had a very big military in the last 70 years, but really only for the last 70 years. I mean, basically starting with halftime of World War II. But the question we should ask ourselves here first is, on a foreign policy level, what's the source of US power globally? Is it that strong military? I think during World War II, you can make a case for that. That, right? I mean, having a strong military is basically a tool for having global power. But is it necessarily the source?
I would argue, by the way, that the Second World War shows exactly that initial deterrence and defense mechanism, right? The United States was actually attacked by Japan and then declared war on by Germany, and it fought back. And in that situation, once you're attacked, a military is incredibly useful. Gandhi was absolutely wrong with this idea that you shouldn't fight back if you get invaded. You absolutely have to, and the United States did, and they won the war together with the Soviet Union and others, of course. But that was within a specific war setting. That was Japan and Germany starting a Second World War, mostly based on Pacific and European interests, without the United States actually being a direct player in those dynamics. Now, when it comes to the US in the 1930s, before the US war machine kicked in, before they very quickly went from hardly having any military to being by far the most powerful military in the world, the United States was already the most influential nation in the world. They had the largest economy, they had the strongest diplomacy. US foreign policy in the 1920s, 1930s was incredibly successful. It was incredibly influential, and the United States managed to achieve most, if not all, but most of its foreign policy goals during that time period without having a use of its military, right? Then it finds itself at the end of the Second World War with this enormous military machine that it could build up because of its enormous economic might. And it has a choice to make. Do we keep it or do we go back to the pre-World War II levels, and decide to keep it in large part out of fear for the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And at that moment, you can see that the military becomes a essential part, or at least a fundamental part, of US foreign policy. And you can see things going horribly wrong, because their basis for power, their basis for influence, was never their military. It was always their economic, cultural, intellectual, and diplomatic influence, very much in line with what the founding fathers wanted in the 18th century.
In order to look at this, let's do a quick basically case study, a table in that sense of looking at some positive examples of how the US military was a force for good for its own foreign policy aims, but also for the world. And then at some negative examples. A lot of them we've talked about in previous episodes. So if you want to hear more about them in detail, please feel free to go to them. But starting with some positive examples. And so this is obviously not an exhaustive list, right? So these are the ones that we came up with just now because they are such clear examples of the US military being a force for good here. And the first one being Desert Storm and Desert Shield. When it was Iraq that attacked Kuwait, right? So very much within the Westphalian system, sovereignty was violated. And the United States, together with the rest of the world and a UN Security Council mandate, came together to basically at first push Iraq out of Kuwait and then kind of push into Iraq, making sure that Saddam Hussein got a clear message to not do this again.
Yeah, and essentially to clip his wings, to ensure Saddam Hussein, by the way, build up through Western support previously. Saddam Hussein was a threat to the region. That was clear through his actions against Kuwait, also previously invading Iran with Western support, by the way. And it was obviously the right thing to do, at least according to the UN, according to global popular opinion, with clear legitimacy for the United States to use its overwhelming military force to make sure that Saddam Hussein would not be a problem in the future. They did that, and I think it's very hard to make a case against them doing that. If they hadn't used their military at that moment, the world would probably be a worse place right now.
Absolutely. And then there's another example of... or at least I think the clearest example that we have nowadays for a good use of the military, and that is protecting global trade lanes, particularly from, and this is already where we need to draw a line, from pirates, not necessarily from other countries, right? So here, the specific example we're talking about are the Somali pirates, right, at the Horn of Africa. But this is, again, within a global context, right? So this is usually a global alliance that kind of protects these trade lanes because everyone has a shared interest in these. And the fact that I think most people can agree that Somali pirates are not necessarily a constructive player on the global stage.
Indeed, and two notes are worth making here. The first is that this distinguishes the Somali pirates from the Houthis at the situation right now in 2024, which is a very different kind of situation where there's no global legitimacy. It's a much more complex issue. So let's make the distinction. And secondly, an interesting observation, unlike the Desert Storm and Desert Shield examples, protecting trade lanes doesn't require an overly extensive military, doesn't require $850 billion budgets to achieve, right? You just need a well-functioning navy, which is exactly what the United States had in the 1920s, 1930s. Protect its own trade lanes. It didn't spend much on the military, but it did have the ability to protect its economic interest. And that makes a lot of sense. And it still makes sense in 2024 to do that. You need to make sure that criminals and other types of destructive or disruptive actors cannot mess around with your economic globalized system.
And then the two last positive examples are a bit more controversial and maybe require a bit of a longer debate, which we've had at other points and will continue to have in the future. The first one is the one of nuclear weapons. Where, right, we actually did two episodes on this, on what is the role of nuclear weapons and is it a positive one? I think both of us agree that nuclear weapons are actually a force for good because they prevent more conflict in the world. And this is good because it decreases human suffering. And then the second one being the arms race leading to the downfall of the Soviet Union. And this one I would now particularly see within U.S. interests, right? Because we're talking about the military being a tool for foreign policy. So if we see it isolated as it is, right? Not overall, whether it's a good thing with if the Soviet Union kind of had its downfall or not. But that arms race, right? So being able to put more money into its military, building up its military quicker and more powerful, and kind of forcing the Soviet Union into this race, ultimately leading to its downfall, for the United States turned out pretty well, right? And you didn't even have to fire a single shot.
Yes, absolutely. So strategically, there was this decision made. We know that the Soviet Union is in trouble. We want to accelerate this process. We're going to create Star Wars. And that was the name of the program that Reagan used at the time. We're going to have all these very expensive initiatives, and that will accelerate the downfall of our rival. And that, you know, exactly as you said, regardless of whether this was the right way to go about it or not, there was a clear foreign policy goal, and the military helped in achieving that foreign policy goal. That makes sense. I should point out, by the way, that you were a little bit quick in to say, hey, nuclear weapons are a force for good in the world. There can be a positive impact on nuclear weapons, right? Rather than, I don't want someone to clip just that one quote from you and say, Darius is looking forward to nuclear holocaust destroying the whole planet. There are lots of problems with nuclear weapons, but what it can do, it can stabilize potentially very volatile situations. And there's a strong case to be made that because of nuclear weapons, less conventional warfare has taken place. And that in itself, limited to that, is a good thing.
Well, if anyone disagrees, feel free to listen to our 2 hours of content we've created us already, and then we can have a discussion based on this. But yeah, thank you very much. To listeners, please don't clip any anything out of context. But at the same time, if you have any more positive examples you can think of the US military being used to achieve its foreign policy goals, feel free to send them to us, and we can have maybe include them in future episodes and have discussions on them. Because now we're moving on to the negative examples. Let me quickly go through like 4 countries that I don't think there's a discussion. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. I think we've said plenty about this in the past. And if people want to argue that these are positive examples, have fun. But then there is a few other elements, or there's one larger element that's very negative, if you ask me, about, right, that there's a very negative impact to the US's militarization. And that's the fact that by you leading the race, the arms race globally, you force other countries to catch up, right? To spend more on its military. And with this, you're creating a more dangerous global environment. I can only recommend to anyone, right, doubting this, to read up on World War One, because, right, that huge military buildup at some point led to an explosion that really just needed a little bit to ignite. And so these tensions and this race that has been created through the US military and the Western military in general in the world is something that cannot be underestimated.
Absolutely. And even in those cases, which I referred to before as well, where people kind of know that they cannot catch up, you know, even China will not be able to catch up with the US anytime soon. But certainly your average country in the world can never hope to be as powerful as the United States in terms of their military. What they will do is they will try to find other ways to be a threat to the United States, to be able to fight back in different ways, because you've got this enormous military monster called the Pentagon that is threatening you, and you have to somehow find a way to defend yourself. And if it's not through conventional warfare, it is through nuclear weapons. If it's not through nuclear weapons, it's through terrorism. Some way you need to fight back against that. And that is something that is hugely underestimated when it comes to this. The idea that the US, by spending $850 billion a year on its military, is actually thereby creating a world that is safe for Americans is absolutely wrong. What it does is that the rest of the world starts trying to find new ways to mess around with the United States, new ways to make America insecure. And so even if you look beyond conventional warfare, these tensions that this creates are deeply, deeply significant.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
You just said something interesting, and I think it was a bit of a shortcut, and it would be interesting to explore this, is you said that, oh, there's the Pentagon sitting, which is a threat to you as another country. And that's interesting that you say this, and it's basically a given fact. But I think we should be taking a step back here, maybe not to the alien level, but maybe to the observer level, of how we can, like, we are at a point now in 2024 where you say a statement like this and I don't question it, right? So, oh, the Pentagon is a monster, a military, big military monster that I would say most countries on this planet perceive as a threat. That, psychologically, that does a lot for the situation. It adds a lot of tension to the already very, like, very, very volatile global environment.
Absolutely. You've got this enormous, almost untouchable machine that you will never be able to beat with tanks or with planes or with it. So what are you going to do? You're gonna have to become creative, right? And I think that statements, there are still, will create some kind of counter reaction in the minds of a lot of people who still somehow believe that just because the Pentagon represents the Western bubble, just because the Pentagon represents a democratic liberal nation, it is not a threat. Well, you might not feel as an American that it's a threat, but the rest of the world absolutely perceives it as such. Just because you think that your country stands for good doesn't mean that the rest of the world believes it, especially given that the rest of the world has seen exactly the list that you went through just, Dario, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, with all those moments. The rest of the world looks at that and thinks, hang on, this is not some actor for peace. This is not some kind of security blanket that we can all use to our advantage. This is an incredibly aggressive monster that needs to in some way be countered. It's like the enormous dragon, and there you are with your little sword. How can you defy fight this enormous dragon that is spewing fire all over the place, right?
Because you also have this omnipresence of that dragon. I mean, there's countless military bases spread all over the world. The United States is active in most countries. I mean, another item on this list here would be the militarization of certain regions, right? And here, particularly the Sahel region, where there's military bases left and right. And then there's also, right, presence in general, increased militarization. And none of this is, first of all, leading to the United States achieving any of its foreign policy goals, but it's also destabilizing the region and just hurting a lot of people.
And now you don't just have a destabilized region and the Sahel, you know, what we've seen with Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, although you see exactly the result of this militarization that you mentioned, but it's not just that the region is destabilized, which is bad enough, but it is seen as being destabilized partially because of you. So regions can destabilize if you're not present as well, but then at least you're not going to be blamed for it. But now it is completely obvious that this war on terror and the demilitarization of the Sahel region as a result of the war on terror has led to dynamics that cannot be controlled by military means. They cannot be controlled by the Pentagon or by NATO or by anyone else. And you've got an awful lot of people who blame the United States and other countries for this, the suffering and the struggles that are taking place on the ground. And so you're not telling me that this in any way either makes your average US citizen safer or allows the White House or the United States as a whole to achieve any of its main political goals. Maybe with a bit of a stretch, you can argue that this destabilized situation makes it easier for outside actors to control natural resources or something like that. But that's about it. There's not much more to it.
And then the last aspect of this is that it's, I mean, apart from having military means, you're going to use it somehow. And usually you use it in a negative way. It creates the dynamics around the world that are very difficult to control and that are leading to more tensions. And lastly, it's also just very costly. You're spending a huge amount of money on this, which maybe is missing at home. And if I listen to the US media at the moment, right, there's so much money missing for infrastructure.
Infrastructure and also just poverty alleviation programs. The whole thing about the student debt and the enormous amounts of money that are being spent on healthcare, but don't actually reach the majority of the Americans. There is so much work to be done within the United States. All the objective statistics show it, right? Increased poverty, worse healthcare for your average American, social programs that are collapsing, huge national debt, enormous national debt. And think about it. The United States could cut its military budget in half and it would still be clearly the largest military power in the world. It could save 400 billion on its military and still not be threatened by China or by Russia, because they would never have the capability of invading. They would never have the possibility of actually being an existential threat to you. And that would be 400 billion a year spent on much more productive purposes, such as education, healthcare, poverty alleviation, infrastructure, etc.
And what now?
Looking into the future, I mean, you already said it, there's a lot of money that could be spent elsewhere, but that money is not being spent elsewhere because within NATO particularly, you have the 2% goal, right? Which means that every NATO member should, should slash has to spend 2% of its GDP on the military. Given that under normal circumstances, a country's GDP is usually growing, that means that also these military budgets will keep on growing, which is a very sneaky way, right, of constantly increasing your military might. Then you also have, right, expansion into other countries where, I mean, now Sweden and Finland have joined. So I don't see a stop to this trend, right? I see constant further militarization within the West, and as a result, also globally, making the world not necessarily a safer place.
Yeah, and so the analysis has to be, where does this come from? If you can't point at actual foreign policy success because of your military, why does this 2% goal exist, and how can we convince society not to stick to that, right? How can we convince our country, the Netherlands, which has just seen a 13% increase in its military, to stop going down this path? I think there are two ways to talk about that, and hopefully the future conversations will go in that direction. The first is basically just to ask the question, please show me what you want to achieve with this military, and don't tell me that you want to avoid Russia invading, because Russia is not going to invade. Stop that, please. And then you have to look at, okay, maybe there's something deeper underneath all of this. Maybe it is just that the West feels incredibly insecure right now, because it knows that it's on the decline. It knows that it no longer has the power that it had 30 years ago. And it creates the military as this kind of fake security blanket, trying to still feel safe in an uncertain future. And so the conversation in the future has to be about that, right? Like, how can we make the West stop feeling so unsafe, accepting that the world is changing, and stop hiding behind a useless military expenditure that only takes the focus away from the things that are really needed?
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the role of the military in the West. If you have any questions, comments, or regards, make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. And we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I almost cancelled our conversation previously because you asked the horrifying question, is Bob Dylan part of the Beatles? Or was he part of the Beatles? Now, this it shows the enormous disrespect that your generation has for the might of Bob Dylan and the Beatles as well, by the way. Go back to the 1960s, listen to the music, it's worth it. Bob Dylan, very much part of the world surrounding Vietnam, wrote many amazing songs, many anti-war songs, and I decided to choose this quote. You that never done nothing, but built to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.